Okay, so we kind of started to talk about this. But it went really fast, so I want to come back and let's fill in some of the blanks because it's important to understand. So, again, the gold standard of what we would like to get is if we have some model that has some parameters theta, we'd really like to know what the posterior probability distribution is. So, what is the probability for that parameter taking certain values given some set of data? And usually we build this by knowing the prior, finding, I'll use the notation, the likelihood, which is the probability of the data given the theory, and then dividing by the evidence, which is the probability of the data. And again, this mostly we just say is proportional to the likelihood function. And the likelihood function is easier to get because it only requires us to build a model that allows us to predict data. Okay? It's easier to go that way than it is to go that way. So the most important case that we started to consider were Gaussian likelihoods. So that actually kind of had two, well, so this is confusing. So what I meant by Gaussian likelihoods was actually that it was Gaussian in the data. So that the likelihood could be written as proportional to data minus some model mean, for example. Well, let's write it like this. So some theory prediction for what that data should be. Divided by, well, we looked at this specific example, so let's just stick with that. So if we have a mean and a variance, then the likelihood could be written in a way that looked like this, which was Gaussian in the data. If we consider our theory to be the mean and the variance, then it's also Gaussian in the mean, but it's not necessarily Gaussian in the variance, right? So it goes like one over the variance. So that was the definition of what we meant by Gaussian. What is it Gaussian in? It's basically Gaussian in data minus theory prediction. Okay. So, right? But there's sort of a special case, which is where the likelihood function is also Gaussian in one of the parameters. Okay? So for example, in any such situation, we could make the likelihood proportional to a Gaussian with some mean and some variance, but in the parameter now. So if we were to make a plot, there would be some prediction for the maximum likelihood value, which we'll call theta hat. And then if we'd like to get an error on our estimate of the parameter, which is the one that maximizes the likelihood, we basically want to know the width of this distribution. Okay. So if it was a Gaussian, then as we talked about last time, we could make a prediction for what that width is by taking the second derivative of the logarithm of the likelihood function with respect to that parameter, evaluating it at the maximum, and then taking it to the minus one half power. So for this example, this was just inequality. If we do this, then we exactly get this, right? So for any likelihood function that is approximately a Gaussian, then this will still work pretty well as a way of estimating the error. And a lot of times it is possible to just redefine the parameters of your theory to make it look like a Gaussian and then do this. So that's a convenient trick. And the other thing to know is that any model that's linear in some parameter will always be Gaussian. So for example, if my theory prediction for the mean is just that, just mu, one parameter, okay, it's Gaussian in mu. So that works. If mu was a complicated function of some other parameter, so I needed to know, I don't know, how many clouds are in the sky and how many birds are in the sky in order to predict the mean, then there's some complicated function, then it wouldn't be Gaussian, okay? But maybe I could change my parameters to absorb all that information into one parameter, in which case it would be Gaussian. Okay, but linear models are always Gaussian. And in many cases, even if the model is not linear, then it's approximately Gaussian. So, a useful thing to do with this piece of information, at least here, explicitly is just true that the prediction for the error was actually independent of the measured values. And so in general, calculating the curvature of the likelihood function around the maximum likelihood value can be done without knowing anything about the values that were actually measured. Okay? Or we could just take an ensemble average, in which case, if we know exactly what the theory is and we take an ensemble average over all the possible measurements, well, in this case, if it's just the mean, then the ensemble average just gives us the mean. So we can use that to predict how well future experiments will do or how far I can shrink error bars on measurements that I have not yet done. Okay. We do that using the Fisher matrix. So that if we had more than one parameter, we can get by looking at all the possible second derivatives of the likelihood function with respect to different parameters. Okay, so if there was a set of parameters and so on and so forth, that the likelihood function depended on, then I just compute this matrix of second derivatives to construct this Fisher matrix. And then we take the ensemble average over an infinite number of measurements. In this case, we get exactly the answer. And in this case, we get some prediction for the answer in general. We just do this in general. So the error on one of these parameters we get by taking the matrix inverse, finding the diagonal component that corresponds to the parameter I'm interested in. Sorry, I don't know why I keep changing my notation. And then taking the square root. Okay, so here we had to take this to the minus 1/2 power. Since there was just one parameter, this was just a number. But in general, if this is a matrix, then we have to be careful that we're actually doing the matrix inverse. And then we take the diagonal component, take the square root. And that is our prediction for how well we can measure this parameter. So there's something called the Kramer-Rao bound. That says that you can't do any better than this. Okay, so if the likelihood function is really Gaussian and you carry through all this, then in an actual measurement, the error bar that you get is always going to be bigger than your prediction from the Fisher matrix. So the Fisher matrix always gives you a sort of best case scenario prediction for how well you can measure different parameters. Okay, so so in the case where the Fisher matrix gave you exactly the ensemble averaged error, then you know your likelihood function is exactly a Gaussian, okay? But in a lot of cases, it will be approximately a Gaussian. And so knowing what the Fisher matrix is allows us to approximate the likelihood function. We just say that it's almost a Gaussian. So the approximate likelihood function is a Gaussian in the parameters where the covariance of that Gaussian is just the Fisher matrix. And then there's a, I always forget. I think there's a 2 there. Don't quote me on that. Right, so so if we have some set of measurements, theta, and we have some predictions for those measurements, theta hat, then we can compute the likelihood function as a function of those parameters using this expression here. This is an approximate likelihood. So for example, if we had a two-dimensional parameter space, so there was just theta 1 and theta 2, so there are two parameters, two hypothetical parameters in this likelihood function. So this is some multivariate Gaussian. And we could draw a contour plot that represents where 68% of the area under this curve lies. And so it would be a Gaussian on this contour plot that would be centered at some true value, right? So some mean value, theta hat 1 and theta hat 2. And then there would be some curve that represents where 68% of the integral of this likelihood function lies, right? So we just basically change the limits of integration until we contain 68% of the probability. And this should, well, look like a lot of papers you probably have opened up or textbooks you read when you see some constraint on some set of parameters in cosmology, for example. This is basically what is plotted, okay? So a few things to know. So first of all, the Fisher matrix, if it's not diagonal, is basically encoding degeneracies between these different parameters. So if this ellipse is not precisely oriented along the axes, then there will be some degeneracies between parameters. So the off-diagonal elements of the Fisher matrix encode parameter degeneracies. Right. And so we can also learn a little bit more deeply or a little bit better what exactly that error bar means that we find there. So So let's just, for simplicity, assume that our theory predicts that these parameters have mean zero. That's one possible choice that just simplify our life. So then this likelihood function is proportional to just theta I Fij theta j. And we could expand this in a way that looks a little bit more matrix notation-like. So we could write this as a row vector. Notice that the Fisher matrix is symmetric because second derivatives are symmetric. So if I can flip the order of second derivatives and I get the same answer. And we have theta 1, theta 2. Okay, and you can expand this out. So we just get minus a half F11 theta 1 squared plus 2 F12 theta 1 theta 2 plus F22 theta 2 squared. Okay, and this would be the likelihood over theta 1 and theta 2 over those two parameters. Okay, for this simple example. So now let's introduce the concept of a marginalized likelihood. So we marginalize over a parameter in our theory by integrating the likelihood function over that parameter. So we could calculate the likelihood function, marginalized likelihood function for theta 1. That's just the integral over theta 2 of the likelihood function for both theta 1 and theta 2. And so if you do this integral, it's just a Gaussian integral in theta 2. And so you end up with a Gaussian. And by brute force, doing that integral, I claim you get the following answer. And then this thing right here, you'll recognize as just the inverse of this matrix here. So it's the 1-1 component of the inverse of the Fisher matrix, okay? Sorry. That's 1 over the inverse. So it's that, excuse me, for the 2. Okay, so this quantity up here is actually the marginalized error. Okay, so you guys did the tutorial. I heard not everyone got to the end, but I hope you had a chance to try question 3 later or have a look at the solutions, because hopefully that drives a little bit of this home, just to have a concrete example of what's going on. And we'll revisit that again and again and again, because this Fisher matrix for a theorist in cosmology It's one of the most useful tools at your disposal. Because you might have a crazy, wacky idea about the early universe, and you probably want to know if it's testable. That's a really easy way to figure out whether or not your crazy idea about the early universe is testable. You come up with an observable that can hopefully constrain your crazy theory described by these parameters theta. And then all you need to do is take a couple second derivatives, and you get to know if your crazy theory can be confirmed by observation. So, really easy way of getting very useful information. So it's definitely a skill that you should have. And we'll do it three or four times, I think, if you take both part one and part two of this course. We will predict different things with the Fisher matrix. Okay, so given the gravity and importance of this thing that I just told you exists, are there any questions or things that I could clarify about that? Excellent.
Do not make use of the posterior distribution here. We just use the likelihood function to calculate the errors.
Very good. So we could go to the posterior, which would be the proper thing to do, in my opinion. And now we get into the little bit of murky water of frequentist statistics versus Bayesian statistics. So the Bayesian thinks that you should encode all of your assumptions and prior knowledge into P of theta in order to really know what your prediction is. Okay? But the frequentist would say, oh, it's good enough to know how likely it is that you get some observation that you made. You know, how likely it is to flip 10 heads in a row on a coin, for example.
So in practice for cosmology, how much difference do the two approaches make? Which one is used?
So it depends on how good your data is, because it's always true that, so if we look at the posterior, let's say we have a likelihood function that looks like, I'm gonna draw a bunch of things, so let me just not do that. So let's say I had a likelihood function that was super peaked in my parameter, but then I had a prior that looked like this. Doesn't make any difference whether or not I'm talking about the likelihood function or the posterior, because the likelihood is far more informative than the prior, right? And so multiplying this by this, I just get the same shape curve. Kills the tails out here that are already tiny. On the other hand, if we were to reverse that situation and we had this, then clearly I should care about knowing about my prior. And so like the short answer is it depends on the situation. But the safest thing, in my opinion, would always be to just calculate the posterior and try and reason through what your prior really is. Yeah. Yep. Any other questions? Okay. And then there's like a whole field about doing this to different degrees and making more complicated models called astrostatistics, which I think is a really interesting field. But we're not going to talk. Sorry. okay. So let's come back to the FRW universe. And for the rest of the day, we're going to talk about how does matter behave in a Robertson-Walker universe. So that was the first part of GR. Space-time tells matter how to move. And then we'll talk about how the stuff in the universe causes it to expand, solving the Einstein equations. That's the second part of GR, which is how does matter tell space-time how to curve. So let's focus on a flat universe. for today to make our lives a little bit simpler. But everything I'm going to say can be generalized to a universe that has some spatial curvature. No problem. It's just a little bit more algebra. Okay. So if we have a metric, we can calculate the geodesics of particles in that space-time. Okay, that's definitely one of the bread and butter things we do, GR. For example, it's really easy to get null geodesics, right? We just set the metric, the space-time interval to zero, and then solve this equation for trajectories, which in this case are pretty easy, right? So we just have the integral over some spatial direction, pick a direction, the x direction, I don't know. And then we just have to do this integral of dt over a, right? And we took a square root, so in general, things, light rays could be going away from us, or they could be coming towards us. So that's really all the freedom there is. So that's the null geodesics in FRW. Okay, so more generally though, if we want to solve for the trajectory of massive particles, or we wanted to learn a little bit more about the trajectory of photons, or what happens to photons as they propagate, we can solve the geodesic equation. Which will always contain this as a special case, one solution, but we can get other solutions. So the geodesic equation was the second order differential equation where lambda is some parameter, the affine parameter that we invent in order to describe the distance along a path, which could either be a null path or a time-like path. And x is just the position for vector. Okay. So in flat FRW, the thing we need to solve this is basically just the connection, right? So we just need the Christoffel symbols, and then we have everything we need. We're going to have a set of four differential equations because mu can be time x, y, z. So in flat FRW, it's pretty easy to figure out what the Christoffel symbols are. These are just built from derivatives of the metric. Okay, and so you could see the metric only depends on time through the scale factor, so there's just going to be things that have to do with the scale factor and its time derivative. So there are non-zero components of this when the upper index is the time index and the lower index is one of the spatial indices, as long as they're both the same spatial index. Okay. And then there are non-zero components where the upper index is a spatial direction, and one of the lower indices is space, and the other one is time. And the Christoffel symbol is symmetric in the lower indices. If we went back to its definition, it's easy to show. And if we do this, we again get something non-zero only when the two spatial indices are the same index. So x, y, or z. Okay, and that's enough information for us to write down what the geodesic equation is in FRW. So there's two equations. That's one of them. And then there's another one. So right over here, so we can work with it in a second. So this is to represent the spatial coordinates with the I. And then this one goes like 2 a dot over a dt d lambda dx I d lambda 0. And the factor of 2 comes because for that equation, the upper index mu is I. And then here, if we look at the non-zero Christoffel connect symbols for upper index I, there's both IT and TI, but it's symmetric and they're equal. So this gives me a factor of 2. Okay. So now what we can do, I'll leave those there for now. Since lambda is a completely arbitrary parameter up to us to define, let's define it in terms of the four momentum of this particle. So let's define the four momentum P alpha as dx alpha d lambda. Okay. And we can fix the normalization by requiring that P, when we use the metric to find the inner product, gives us minus m squared. So that's just the general relativistic generalization of the normalization of the four momentum in special relativity. We just swapped out the eta mu nu for a g mu nu. That's it. Okay. And so then we can give names to the different components. So we can call the P0 component E for energy. And then we can call the spatial components PI. Those will be the generalization of momentum, just spatial momentum. And with those definitions, here, when we expand this out, we get minus E squared plus A squared PI EI, okay, where the repeated index means sum them up. So that's just the vector product of P with P. Okay. And you can see that it only differs from the special relativistic version of this equation by this factor of A. Okay. So the usual special relativistic P is related to this P by a factor of the scale factor. Okay, another useful thing we can do here is we can use this definition, right? So from this, we know that dt d lambda is just equal to E by definition, okay? And from this, we know that we could write a derivative with respect to this affine parameter, so defined, just using the chain rule. In terms of a time derivative by putting a factor of E. Make that so you can all see it. Okay, so this allows us to change this derivative with respect to the affine parameter into a derivative with respect to something more physical, T. All right. So now we can come back to these two equations and we can write them in a more pedestrian form. So for this first equation, we could write this as dd lambda of k dt d lambda. Okay. We can already use our definition here. So we have a dot. That's just pi pi by definition. Okay, and now we can use, by definition, this is what we called E, and we can turn the dd lambda into a ddt by putting a factor of E as well. Okay, so this equation then gives us E dE dt plus AA dot PI PI equals zero. Okay, so now this equation is written in terms of physical quantities. Okay. We can do a similar thing here now. So we can write this as dd lambda dxi d lambda plus 2a dot over a. This, again, by definition, is just e. And this is bi. Okay, and then we can turn this into a derivative with respect to t and recognize that that is pi to get e dpi dt plus 2a dot over a e bi is equal to zero. Okay. So now this equation is written entirely in terms of more physical quantities. So from this equation, well, there's a factor of E here and a factor of E here. So we can cancel those out. And now we have an equation for just P, which we can solve. So from this equation, we know that dP over P is equal to minus 2 dA over A. And then take the integral of both sides. Easy to see that P just goes like 1 over A squared. So we could normalize it by some constant and then divide by A squared. Okay? So the momenta of particles, so defined, in a Robertson-Walker universe decreases with time as the scale factor grows. So in an expanding universe, as A gets bigger, it goes down. Okay, so that's kind of useful.
One question, sir?
Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Is that simply saying that that's the reason there is a redshift?
Wait one second. Wait one second, and then we'll see that. Yeah, that we're almost there. But you're anticipating incorrectly.
Thank you.
Say hello to your colleagues at York University, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks for asking a question, Kshitij. You guys should all ask questions remotely. Please feel comfortable doing that. So now what we can do is using the normalization of the four momentum, we have this expression here on the upper right that lets me relate energy, m, and the spatial components of p to now figure out how, since m is a constant, the energy evolves with the scale factor. Okay, so if we just plug in this result, that p goes like 1 over a squared, getting 1 over a to the fourth, right? Two of the powers of a cancel, and if we solve for e, we see that e is the square root of m squared plus p over a squared, okay? And now, of course, there are the interesting limits, which would be to take the relativistic limit and the non-relativistic limit of this expression. Okay. So first, the relativistic limit. And here's where we see redshift. Okay, so if we set m squared to 0, then we're just left with E equals some constant divided by A. Question?
Okay, I'm looking for the squares. It should be 0 I squared.
Oh, yeah, I just forgot the square. Thanks. Indeed. Okay, so the energy of a particle, and I should probably put the absolute value here because E can only be positive, but momentum can be positive or negative. So the energy goes down like the scale factor. And for a photon, energy is h bar omega. So that means the frequencies go down as the universe expands, AKA the redshifts, or sorry, the wavelengths get longer as the universe expands. And so gravitational redshifting is a consequence of geodesic motion of photons in an expanding universe. Okay? That's what we learned from this. Okay, so we could also look at the non-relativistic particles and see what geodesic motion implies for non-relativistic particles. Okay. So let's look at P and think about what P means. So we define this as dx d lambda. And we can use our trick to write this as E dx dt. So remember, the positions x are co-moving coordinates. And so this is like the velocity in terms of the co-moving coordinates. Call it a co-moving velocity, I don't know, for lack of a better name. Okay, so then that's great. So we could now look at the energy here. And we could expand that for m squared much bigger than p squared over a squared. So if we did that, we'd find that the energy is roughly equal to m plus a squared p vector squared over 2m, the usual thing, just with the a, okay? And of course, if we put in what p is doing, so p0, then this is going down, okay? So one thing we learn is that in an expanding universe, the kinetic energy of a particle gets smaller. So the kinetic energy of the particle is damped, just like the energy of the photon was damped. Okay? And that kinetic energy goes down like a squared. And a consequence of the kinetic energy getting smaller is that if we take this definition of the energy and plug it back into here, is that solving for dx dt, we'll get, after just a little bit of algebra, this expression. Okay. So I just shuffled the E to the other side and made P I P I naught over A squared. So what we see here, well, first of all, you might want to know about the sign. So the sign of this thing in here is positive definite because of the normalization condition. So this has got to be greater than one, 0, this whole thing. And then there's a minus sign out front. And so the implication is that the co-moving velocity is always decreasing. And so the trajectory of any particle, of any massive particle in an expanding universe, is that it just asymptotes, just slows down in co-moving coordinates. And so it asymptotes to a constant co-moving position. So massive particles asymptote to a constant co-moving position. Okay, and that is why we always make the assumption that in an expanding universe, objects typically occupy a constant co-moving position. Okay, because if they did have any co-moving velocity, if they were moving in co-moving coordinates, they would quickly slow down. Okay, and so this result here is the reason why we usually make that assumption, and you know why that assumption is true in nature when we observe stuff. So co-moving velocities damp, that means everything inhabits a constant co-moving position. Okay, so with that, you now know everything you need to know about how particles move in FRW. And next we can ask about continuous media. So how do fluids evolve in FRW? Okay, so a perfect fluid is described by an energy momentum tensor that looks like so. Where rho is the energy density. P is the pressure. These are four velocities. So four velocities are defined the same as momenta. With a slightly different choice of affine parameter, such that the normalization is minus one and not minus m squared. Okay, so if we were to relate four velocity and four momenta for a massive particle, it's just p over m. Okay, so in order to describe a perfect fluid, we basically need to know how the pressure and energy density evolve with time. You could postulate that the pressure and energy density were like functions of both time and space, but that would fly in the face of our symmetry assumption about FRW, where it's the same everywhere in space. So the matter in it should be the same everywhere in space. Okay. So in general, this can only be a function of time in FRW. Now, in principle, the pressure and the energy density are totally unrelated, or they could have an arbitrary relation. But for most of the stuff we care about in cosmology, they're just related by a constant factor, which is the equation of state parameter. So the pressure is typically related to the energy density by this factor W, which is the equation of state parameter. And for most of the stuff that we know and love in the universe, we know what the equation of state parameter is. So from first principles, one can derive that W is equal to 1/3 for a gas of relativistic non-interacting particles, which we'll call radiation. Okay. So if I just have a gas of photons, or if you remember when you computed blackbody radiation, you found that the energy density and the pressure were related by a factor of 1/3. W equals 0, you get by assuming you have a bunch of particles that have some rest mass completely at rest. Question?
We still have the normalization of the for velocity, if we have only photons, it would be the same, even if it's massive.
It's the same, yeah. So the normalization is the same, except for then U mu just equals P mu, and I don't worry about the M. Yeah, good question. But for this example, we're going to assume that our fluid is made of elements that cannot move at the speed of light. So let's just assume for the moment that it's time-like. That, in fact, is kind of a necessary assumption for a reason that I'll say in a minute. But yeah. So another case of interest is if I have just a bunch of massive particles. If I took a bunch of massive particles just sitting here, then they would be described by an equation of state parameter where W is 0. In other words, they just have energy density, they don't have pressure. Because a bunch of stuff just sitting here does not bang on the walls of a container. It just sits here. So it just has energy density. And then the third case that is usually of interest for our universe is a cosmological constant. And that's described by an equation of state parameter where W is minus 1. So that the pressure is equal to minus the energy density. And then there's, you know, in principle, there could be stuff in between. So one important thing that happens in cosmology is when matter is charged and it interacts with radiation, and then you get a fluid that's a mix of matter and radiation, okay, and the equation of state parameter is a little bit different. So there's this, and then there's some stuff in between. That's the basic model. Okay. Its simplest now. Okay, so we want a universe that is homogeneous and isotropic. And so in Einstein equations, when we're solving for the metric given an energy momentum tensor, the symmetries of the energy momentum tensor had better match the symmetries of the space-time we're shooting for. And so that implies that this energy momentum tensor had better be spatially homogeneous and isotropic, okay? That gave these conditions, but that condition also tells me that this U mu has to be time-like so that I can always find a frame where the fluid is at rest. Because if something depends on time and I do a Lorentz transformation, guess what? It also depends on space. So there had better be a frame in which the fluid is at rest. Okay? So the fact that we are going to try and go for a universe that has homogeneity and isotropy implies that there is a frame where the fluid is at rest and the universe looks homogeneous and isotropic. So in this frame, the four velocity is really simple. It's just 1, 0, 0, 0. If we want to lower an index, we get a minus sign. Okay. And this statement here is kind of a funny statement that flies in the face of like a folklore comment about general relativity, which is that, oh, it's GR is supposed to be independent of coordinates, so there should be no preferred frame. Well, guess what? In cosmology, there's a preferred frame. It's defined by this, okay? So it's just not true that any solution of general relativity has to be invariant under changes of coordinates, okay? Just the theory itself. So it's fine, but just know that cosmology most absolutely definitely has a preferred frame. It's defined by this frame right here. Okay, so then, given this energy momentum tensor, we could ask, what does conservation of energy and momentum for this fluid look like in the Robertson-Walker universe? Okay, so we get a set of conservation laws. Remember that what conservation of energy and momentum look like in general relativity is this. It's that the covariant derivative of the stress tensor is zero. So I've chosen to lower one index because the stress tensor looks simpler when I lower one index because I get rid of all the factors of A. So in particular, when I lower an index, we still got rho plus p. We take one of our four velocities and we lower it. But then the nice thing that happens is that when I contract the metric with itself, I get a delta function. Okay, so this is just diagonal when mu is alpha. And that means that we could write T mu nu, and I'm in, this board doesn't move, sorry. Let's do it over here so you can actually see what I'm writing. So when we write with one index up and one index down, the stress tensor is diagonal with minus rho up here and then p's on the spatial components of the diagonal. You get that. So the 0, 0 component is just 1 times minus 1. So minus rho plus p equals minus rho. And you can do the other ones for yourself. Okay, so we can look at the alpha equals 0 component of that conservation law. And that'll turn out to be sufficient to get what we want. Okay, so we want to compute this. So we flip open the notes to figure out how to take the covariant derivative of a 1-1 tensor. And the answer is we need these two combinations of Christoffel symbols. And I wouldn't be able to reproduce that from memory, so just look it up in a book. Yeah, we could probably do it, but anyway. Right, so let's think about what the different components are. So here we know that things only depend on time. So the only non-vanishing component here is when mu is the time index. So in other words, that's missing an index, isn't it? Zero. So in other words, the zero, zero index of the stress tensor. So this first term just gives us minus d rho dt, okay? Then we have to remember what the Christoffel connections are. That's a cool trick up there. Okay, so here in this one up, one down index, T is diagonal. So beta therefore is zero, or T. Sorry, I've again like brutalized the notation. So we need one connection where one of the lower indices is T. And that's the one on the upper right, the a dot over a delta ij. Okay. So from this one, we get a factor of 3 because of this repeated index. I need to sum over the spatial indices, and there's 3 of them. So we get a 3 a dot over a, and then we get a minus rho, because that's t. 0, 0. Let's hope I don't screw the sign up. Good. Okay, so then we come to here. So we have upper and lower index, but we know that one of the lower indices on the connection is t. And the only non-zero one where the lower index is t is, again, the upper right one. But then we require that gamma and mu are the same. Okay. And again, I have to worry about the fact that I have repeated indices. And so I get a factor of 3 when I contract these two indices with these two. So we get a 3 a dot over a. And here I just have the spatial components, which are p. So we get a p. All right. So we can just now rearrange this ever so slightly to get an equation. Let's get rid of a minus sign. So we've got, okay, let's keep the minus sign, otherwise I'll get confused. So we've got a minus 3 rho, and then a minus 3 p. So we can make everything plus. We get 3 a dot over a rho plus p. So this is what conservation of stress energy means for a perfect fluid. Okay, so we have this relation. You could evaluate the other components, and you'll get another equation, but this time for P. But we don't need that, because we assume a relationship between rho and P. In fact, you get kind of a useless equation for P that would require you to specify some rho as a function of P. So if we use this relation between rho and p, then we know that d rho dt plus 3 a dot over a rho one plus w equals zero. Okay, and now we can solve this for rho as a function of a. So from this, we just find that we have d rho over rho is equal to minus dA over A times 3, 1 plus W. Okay. And that we can solve. So it's a power law solution. Where A goes like minus 3, 1 plus W. Okay, so fluids, the density, the energy density of fluids evolves in an expanding universe. From here, we can learn some interesting things just about that general statement. So first of all, you can see that we have this factor. And the energy density in a fluid will go down so long as this is positive, right? Then the derivative will be negative. So fluids dilute when rho plus p is greater than or equal to zero. This turns out to be an important physical property of fluids, because if it was not true, then these fluids would do very strange things. So as the universe expanded, the fluid would become more dense. And that's not usually how things behave. Usually as the universe expands, fluid becomes more diffuse. So there are so-called energy conditions in GR, and this thing corresponds to the null energy condition, this inequality here. And if you were to violate the null energy condition, then you can send signals faster than light by making waves in your fluid, because the speed of sound in these fluid waves would be faster than the speed of light. Bad. So that's another reason you don't want fluids that don't dilute. Because you can have a causal strange behavior from fluids that don't dilute. So usually we don't consider that. Note that for W equals minus 1, that's a cosmological constant. You're on the boundary, right? So if we put W equals minus 1, then d rho dt is 0. So densities don't change in time. Okay, so a cosmological constant is a strange fluid. Does not dilute as the universe expands. We could look at the other cases. So when W equals zero, that's supposed to be dust or matter, right? So just particles that sit there. the energy density goes like 1/a³, and that's just the increase in volume. Okay, so this is like literally just the number density going down as the volume of the universe goes up. We could look at radiation. So if W is a third, then we get 4/3/3, and the energy density goes down like 1/(scale factor)^4. 1/a³, because the density of photons, say, is going down. But we get another 1/a penalty because the energy of all those photons, each one of them, is going down by 1/a. And so on and so forth. Okay? But it makes physical sense what comes out. right? Another consequence of this is that, for example, in our universe where we have matter, we have radiation, we think we have a cosmological constant, there are different eras where these different types of fluids will dominate the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so if we considered a multi-component fluid, so the total density was the density, say, in matter, plus the density in radiation, plus the density in a cosmological constant. This is given by some matter density today over A cubed, some radiation density today over A to the fourth, and then lambda doesn't change in time, like I told you. Okay, so if we make a plot a magical log plot where everything is a straight line if it's a power law. If you've never experienced the magic of log plots, they are magical. So everything is a straight line. So if we have rho lambda, oh, I can use colors. Rho radiation. And rho matter. Radiation falls steeply. So as A gets small, the radiation density comes to dominate. On intermediate scales, there's some crossover where the radiation density and matter density are equal. But then matter is diluting more slowly, so it has a shallower slope, until finally we get to the time where the matter term has diluted sufficiently that this lambda term picks up. Okay? And so then that ends up dominating everything in the future. And because lambda saturates this energy condition and also the physical condition that fluids should dilute when the universe expands, it doesn't matter how small lambda is. Eventually, in any universe, lambda always wins. So in the extreme future, the cosmological constant in a universe always dominates the energy density. So more or less, this is what happened in our universe, we think, right? At very early times, things were dominated by relativistic particles. You had this long period of time where matter dominated the scene, and now, very recently, the cosmological constant is coming to dominate the energy budget of the universe. Okay, so that's the stuff in the universe. And what remains is to talk about how the stuff in the universe causes it to expand. Okay, so basically we want to solve the Einstein equations. For an energy momentum tensor that looks like that. Okay, so in order to solve this, we need to know for the FRW metric what are the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. So I just quote the result for you. So the Ricci tensor is diagonal, where the 0, 0 term is negative 3 a double dot over a. And then the spatial diagonals are that. And then the Ricci scalar, which is just g mu nu r mu nu, is like the sum of all those diagonal components with some factors of the scale factor. Okay. So that's what we need for the left-hand side. We already know the right-hand side. And we could just look at the different components of the Einstein equations now. Okay, so we could look at the 0, 0 component, time component. So that's just r 0, 0 plus a half, g 0, 0, which is minus 1, r. And that should equal 8 pi g t 0, 0. Okay, so we could just plug stuff in. So we have over here minus 3 a double dot over a. And then like I missed a sign somewhere because things are not going to work out my way. Pretty sure I missed a sign there. So then here, now we're going to get a plus 3. A double dot over A plus A dot over A squared. And that is 8 pi G. And then t 0, 0, we got to get an extra minus sign, so that's just got a row. Okay, so this guy cancels with this guy, and we're just left that a dot over a squared is 8 pi with a 3, the 3 over here, row. Okay. And this is the first Friedman equation. We call this the Hubble parameter. Okay, and so this tells us how to solve for A as a function of time, given some energy density. We can get another equation by looking at the II component. I'll let you derive that for yourself in the interest of time. But this gives us an equation for the second derivative. In terms of the energy density and the pressure. If I want to use this equation, then you can think of the first Friedman equation as providing the initial condition on A dot. Okay, so then we can just solve it. We're almost done, so give me 3 more minutes or so. Okay, so usually we, again, are looking at these solutions where P is W rho. And we know that for these solutions that the density, if we have a single component, is just rho naught A to the minus 3, 1 plus W. And so we can plug that into the right-hand side of the first Friedman equation. So we get a dot over a squared. That's 8 pi g over 3 rho naught a to the minus 3 1 plus w. We could give that a name if we want. When a equals 1, that's the Hubble parameter. We call that the Hubble constant. Okay, now we can just rearrange this equation and solve for A. So again, it's a power law solution. Let's say that there's some constant. We'll call it T naught. Okay, then this A goes like T to the 2 over 3, 1 plus W. We just stick this in, you can check that that solves that equation. Okay. And T naught you can think of as basically the age of the universe. Because when T is T naught, A equals 1, and A equals 1 today. And we could solve for T naught in terms of this Hubble constant. And that is 2 over H naught times 3 1 plus w. And then there's the special case when w equals minus 1 and the power law solution doesn't work. And in that case, it's e to the h naught t, the De Sitter solution. Okay, so a few things here. We can see how A expands with T for choice values of W. So A goes like T to the 2/3 power for matter. A goes like T to the 1/2 power for radiation. So we see that the universe expands a little bit faster, the smaller w is. And that keeps going until w is minus 1, when it expands exponentially fast. Yeah. What else do we see? We see that the age of the universe is always parameterized by this Hubble constant, more or less, like up to an order 1 factor. Question?
Yeah, so I was going to say T0 depends on w, so is this the way we determine the age of the universe, or assuming a certain content of the universe, or do we have another way of saying the age of the universe is roughly this, so the matter content should be this?
So usually if you open up a paper and you see the age of the universe is 13.8 billion years, what they've done is used the measurement of all the stuff in the universe to basically use this equation to back it out. So if I had a measurement and it told me the universe was only made of matter, and I measure the Hubble constant today using supernova, then I could tell you how old the universe is, right? Just 2/3 H naught inverse. There are other ways people try and estimate the age of the universe, which is like finding really old things. So people look for the oldest stars. That's a rough guess for the age of the universe. People look for the most distant objects. So the distance to the cosmic microwave background, for example, or a very distant first galaxy or quasar would be another estimate of age. So you can measure the distance in different ways. But mostly, you figure out what the universe is made of, and then you infer how old it is using an equation like this.
Do we know W for dark matter?
Zero. It's non-interacting, non-relativistic matter. In other words, the elements of fluid, if we look on really large scales, are just sitting there, doing nothing interesting. So it looks like a bunch of stuff that just sits there. Okay. Okay, any other questions? Okay. I just define one thing and we'll come back next time to talk about it. So you see these density parameters? So we can define density by the density over something called the critical density. And the critical density is defined by three h squared over 8 pi g. Just a definition to know. We'll talk next time about multi-component fluids, where we'll find that for a flat universe, if I have a number of components, this sums to one and allows us to make the pie chart of the universe, the only pie chart in physics that I'm aware of. Okay, so I think we're over time and we'll just have to leave it there.